Have you ever wondered how much fish we sell on the Kenai, or how much oil comes from here, what it's all worth, and what it all means? Well, we have too. That's why we created Econ 919, a weekly look at the Kenai Peninsula's economy, what makes it work, and who makes it work. Tune in each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for new numbers, emerging trends, and a bit of trivia. Econ 919, Friday mornings at 9 and again at 5, right here on KDLL, public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and this is FM 91.9 KDLL, Kenai Soldotna. On this month's beer style segment, we're going to talk about one of the most unique and amazing styles of beer out there, the barrel-aged and blended style of Belgian lambic, known as Guse. That's spelled G-U-E-U-Z-E, and is the French name for the style. In Belgium, they speak French in the south and Dutch in the north, but after growing up in New Orleans, my French is considerably better than my Dutch, so we'll stick to Guse. But before we start talking about Guses in particular, let's talk about lambics in general. Lambic is a sour wheat beer style brewed in and around Brussels. What makes lambic unique is the utilization of medieval or even more ancient fermentation techniques in its production, rather than the modern microbiological practices developed by Louis Pasteur and Emil Christian Hansen in the late 19th century. Lambics are produced using a complex fermentation based on locally and naturally occurring wild yeast and bacteria, making them the prototype of so-called wild ales now being created by craft brewers all over the world. Within the family of lambics, there are several beer styles, including fruit beers such as Creeks and Framboise, flavored with cherries and raspberries respectively, and Faro, a lambic that has been sweetened with sugar. But today we are interested in that most highly respected of lambic beer styles, Guse. Guse is an unfruited, sparkling form of lambic that many regard as the epitome of sour beer production. Sometimes called the champagne of Belgium, Guse is a blend of two or more lambics of different ages, with the younger beer providing the sugars needed for fermentation in the bottle. Guse almost certainly predates champagne and was probably originally served directly from the cask, but today it is almost exclusively a bottled beer. The traditional Guse flavor is dry, sharp, earthy, close to that of unblended lambic, but bottle conditioning and the resulting carbonation give it even greater complexity and finesse. Like blending wines or Scotch whiskies, blending lambics of various ages to make a Guse is an art form. Since the base lambics have been spontaneously fermented, each barrel will have a strong individual character. Upon tasting it, the blender will have to decide whether to use the barrel now or hold it further, and whether to use it for some other lambic style, such as a fruited beer, or to use it for the brewery's best traditional Guse. Highly aromatic, old, stinky Guse is considered quite valuable and will be used very carefully. These old lambics have barnyard aromatics reminiscent of washed Rhine cheese, which is not surprising given that the same wild yeast and bacteria are at work in both the beer and the cheese. The goal of the blender is to produce a pleasing union of the individual lambics. Young lambics provide fermentable sugars and bright, vibrant flavors to the blend. Aged lambics lend complexity of flavor along with enzymes created by the dozens of microorganisms resident in the wood of the cask. These enzymes will break down complex sugars into simple sugars that yeast and bacteria can then consume to produce carbonation. The Guse blender must not only carefully manage the characteristics of taste and acidity of each different lambic, but also make sure that the beer will attain the proper high carbonation desired after bottle conditioning. The proportions of young and old lambic in a Guse differ from year to year and from one brewer to another. Some brewers use approximately 50% one-year-old, 25% two-year-old, and 25% three-year-old lambic. Others prefer two-thirds one-year-old and one-third two- or three-year-old lambic. Special blends may include as little as 10% young beer. After blending, the beer is bottled and laid down in cellars for at least 4 to 6 months of re-fermentation. Some may not be released for many years. When they are eventually served, the bottles may come to the table in a special basket to maintain the bottle in a horizontal position. This allows the yeast deposits to remain in place while the beer is poured out sparkling and clear. So how does a fine traditional goose taste? Well, it's something close to a very dry white wine, but because of the excellent carbonation, it's effervescent and refreshing, like the finest champagne. There will be some tartness, and the more traditional the goose, the greater that degree of that tartness. There will also be many interesting so-called barnyard elements, depending on the percentage of truly old lambics used. In short, gooses taste almost nothing like you would expect a beer to taste. There's no hop flavor or aroma. The beer is bone dry and tart rather than malty. Some people hate them when they first taste them, then grow to love them, while others never do. But whether you love them or hate them, gooses are a piece of living history and a strong reminder that beer is easily the most complex alcoholic beverage in the world today. If you'd like to try a goose, it's obviously not something you can find at a local brewery. However, bottle versions are available at Country Liquors in Kenai or at bottle shops in Anchorage. Don't waste your time looking for this one at Safeway or Fred Meyer. We'll be right back here on Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Join us for the Veritas Variety Review as we aim to entertain while seeking what is true. With a plethora of mixed media, music, meandering discourse, and maybe a little mayhem. Tune into KDLL 91.9 at 7 p.m. on Saturday evenings, featuring a new thematic perspective with auditory stimulus to augment your analysis of the universe.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's Brewing Science segment, we're going to talk about adjuncts. In the world of brewing, the term adjunct refers to any ingredient other than malted wheat or barley that is added to a beer to supply fermentable sugars. Examples of typical adjuncts include oats, rye, corn, rice, honey, and various sugars. A brewer might use adjuncts for any number of reasons, ranging from saving money by employing a cheaper source of fermentable sugar to trying to favorably impact some element of the finished product's quality, such as color, flavor, or head retention. Adjuncts have been derided by craft beer lovers because of their wide use in many major American beer brands to lighten the color and the flavor of the beer produced. It would be impossible to brew a beer as light in body as Budweiser using 100% barley malt, as barley contains too many unfermentable sugars, which would remain and contribute to the beer's body. Only by using highly fermentable adjuncts such as corn can such a beer be produced. All the major American lager brands use some combination of corn and/or rice to achieve their current low state of malt flavor. However, many uses of adjuncts are quite traditional. American colonists often supplemented their mash with whatever starch was at hand, with pumpkins being a particularly popular adjunct. In the mid-19th century, German lager brewers who established themselves in the American Midwest found the six-row barley grown there to be much heavier and harsher tasting than the two-row European variety which they had been accustomed to use. In order to produce their beloved lager beers using six-row barley, these brewers hit upon adding corn to the mash bill to produce quality lagers using inferior barley. Though initially done to compensate for not having access to European barley, this practice of using adjuncts was gradually taken to extreme, eventually producing the insipid American lagers of today. Many Belgian and Belgian-style beers also use sugar as an adjunct, adding candy sugar, which is often caramelized to add color and flavor to the beer. In particular, dark candy sugar, usually in the form of a heavy syrup, gives many dark Belgian beers distinctive raisin-like caramel flavors. These sugars, frequently used as up to 20% of the mash bill, are highly fermentable and can help beers obtain a very low residual sugar profile, meaning the beers can have higher alcohol content without having heavy mouthfeel. Kenai River Brewing in Soldotna is famous for its Gummy Bear Triple, a Belgian-style beer in which the adjunct sugar comes from the addition of several pounds of the aforementioned candies to the boil. American craft brewers use various sugars to attain high specific gravities in other beer styles such as barley wines, double IPAs, and other strong ales. Honey is another popular adjunct, which can be added to the brew kettle to increase specific gravity or even post-fermentation, where it adds sweetness and honey aromatics. While today's adjuncts have a bad reputation amongst beer lovers, given their role in producing beers such as Budweiser or Coors, there is in fact a long tradition behind their use in brewing. Used properly and for the right reasons, they are an essential tool in the home or craft brewer's toolkit. We'll be right back here on Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
You know, when you get up in the morning and you're struggling to find the coffee pot, sometimes it helps to have a friendly voice, keeping you calm and informed. Well, that's what we do here. I'm Jay Barrett. You might remember me from 20 years ago when I worked here before. Well, I'm back, and I'm happy to be your guide from 6 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday here on listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Hello, and welcome back to our last segment here on Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm your host, Bill Howell, so let's talk beer gear. In past beer gear segments, I've made recommendations as to different growlers that you might want to purchase. However, it just recently occurred to me that there might be listeners out there who aren't really familiar with the terms like growler and crowler, so I thought that in this segment, I would do a bit of a deep dive into the history and meaning of those terms. Growlers are containers used to transport and store beer that is typically purchased from a retail store, restaurant, brew pub or brewery, and poured from a keg through a tap system. They are often made from glass, stainless steel, or ceramic materials, which help preserve beer for a period of time with minimal degradation. This preservation length can vary, lasting from a couple of days to upwards of a couple of weeks or even longer, depending on certain features available with some models of growler. Preservation length is also impacted by your retailer's ability to purge your growler with carbon dioxide prior to filling it with your beer of choice. If used properly, growlers can offer the drinker a straight-from-the-tap drinking experience that can be taken on the go. It also allows the drinker to take home and share unique brews which will never be packaged in cans or bottles. However, if used or filled improperly, growlers can negatively impact the beer inside them, resulting in a very inferior drinking experience. Growlers come in a variety of shapes and sizes, which is fitting given the origin of the growler has been explained by several different theories. One theory claims that 2-quart galvanized pails were used as early as the late 19th century to transport beer between the local pub and home. As the beer sloshed and its dissolved carbon dioxide was agitated, a growling sound could be heard as gas escaped around the lid. In fact, growler as a term for this vessel first appeared in the June 1893 issue of Harper's Magazine. By the early 20th century, a term rushing the growler had emerged to describe how children would take a pail to a bar, have it filled with beer, and then transport it, most often, to their father's workplace in time for lunch. Some have suggested that the term growler came from the fact that the workers would be so hungry by the time the pails arrived, their stomachs were growling. Another story was that when nickel beer was the standard cost for a pint, those who wanted a pint would use their quart pail, but only have a single pint poured into it. Often there would be a disagreement between the bartender doing the filling and guessing how much to pour and the patron doing the buying, thus causing some growling between the two. Prohibition put an end to the practice of taking pails of beer home from saloons, and after repeal, the growing number of home refrigerators shifted the emphasis to bottles and cans for home consumption of beer. With the emergence of craft brewing in the 1980s, the first use of the current ubiquitous 64-ounce glass jug is credited to Charlie Otto, owner of Wyoming's first draft-only craft brewery, Otto Brothers Brewery, now Grand Teton Brewing. In 1989, Charlie was looking for a way his patrons could bring his beer home, and it was his father who remembered the use of growlers from the time of his youth. Charlie stumbled upon a supply of half-gallon glass jugs, which looked vaguely like moonshine jugs, had his brewery's logo silkscreened on the front, and the rest is craft beer history. While the common glass growler is much the same as it was in 1989, growlers do continue to evolve, but each one's main purpose remains constant. Transport beer from the brewery brew pub bar to some other place and keep beer from going bad for a reasonable amount of time. But how does a growler do that? Bottling and canning lines are designed to fill their respective vessels with beer for longer shelf lives. With growlers, the expectation is consumption will follow within days, so fancy counterpressure systems which purge all the air from the container are not as necessary with filling a growler. However, a good brewery or beer bar will take care when filling a growler. More common these days, if not mandatory, is to use a foot-long tube to bottom-fill growlers. These keep the beer from being splashed and agitated by the long fall from the tap to the bottom of the vessel and releasing its carbon dioxide prematurely. Some finer beer bars will go so far as to purge the oxygen from a growler with CO2 before filling to reduce the risk of oxidation, which is the process that causes beer to go stale. Growlers of beer will stay fresh for several days, some say up to 10 days, if left unopened. Once opened, however, leftover beer will be flat and oxidized within 36 hours at best. If a growler is filled with the full counterpressure system, it's possible for the beer to remain fresh for up to several months. Of course, beer in growlers is susceptible to the same perils as bottled and canned beer. Keep it away from sunlight, store it cold if possible, and store it upright. Many brewers are leery of filling growlers brought into their brewery by customers due to concerns about such growlers' cleanliness. For example, Paul Wheeler of Haynes Brewing will fill no growlers but his own, and when you bring in a growler for a refill, he does not actually fill that growler. Instead, he uses another growler, one that he has personally cleaned, to fill your order. The growler you brought in goes into the stack to be cleaned later. Given the trouble Paul is willing to go to, it should be clear that keeping growlers clean is very important. It's best to rinse them as soon as they are emptied, scrubbing with a long-handled brush if available, and allow them to dry upside down so no moisture is left sitting at the bottom. If you have a growler that you cannot get clean, there are cleaning tablets available online which you can dissolve in the growler to soak off stubborn stains. However you do it, you should ensure that your growler is clean. Otherwise, the beer from it will not taste the way the brewer intended it to. A recent offshoot of the growler is the new container known as a crowler, which is a mashup between the words can and growler. It's a 32-ounce aluminum can which can be filled either in advance or on order from a tap like a growler and then sealed with a small seamer device, producing for all intents and purposes a quart can of beer. This so-called crowler is unbreakable and considerably lighter than a glass bottle of the same size. It's perfectly opaque, so the beer inside is protected from light, and the seams provide a tighter seal than most screw-on caps, helping to keep carbon dioxide pressure in and oxygen out. Crowlers have become very popular in many breweries and brewpubs in Alaska, as they provide an ideal way for tourists to carry beer home. There are also high-tech growlers on the market which have their own carbonation systems, allowing them to function like mini kegs. There are several versions out there, the two most popular being the U-Keg from Growlerworks and the various size growlers manufactured by Mancan. Such growlers will set you back a couple of $100 depending on how fancy you want them, but they do an exceptional job of preserving the beer inside them and allowing you to consume it at your leisure, free from the ticking spoilage clock which starts when you open a standard growler. In closing, I'd like to point out that growlers have two very important benefits for a beer fan. First, they provide a way to source seasonal, limited beers that are likely not to be packaged or distributed beyond the brewery's taproom. Secondly, the growler itself is something personal, a statement about one's brewery allegiance or taste in art or one's lifestyle. Growlers are used again and again. They travel, they get passed around, they get admired. They are an essential tool for the craft beer lover. Well, that's it for this month's show. This month's closing beer quote is from Hunter S. Thompson, journalist and author, the founder of the Gonzo Journalism Movement. There is an ancient Celtic axiom that says, good people drink good beer, which is true then as now. Just look around you in any public bathroom and you will quickly see, bad people drink bad beer. Think about it. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and I hope we'll see you again here next month on Drinking on the Last Frontier. Until then, cheers. Beer on the last frontier.